Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 through 24. I'm gonna attempt something that went wonky on me on the last gathering, and I had to wing my sermon. So let's just pray that that doesn't happen again. Although I think it went okay, even if it does. I'm getting like technologically savvy here. This is so great. Okay, just a second. All right, there we go. Wait, no, come on. Okay, there you go. So, beginning in Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 to 24, Jesus is now moving from our devotions toward our goals. Because I want us to just think about this idea that your goals are often your gods. Just think about that. That your goals are often your gods. So read with me, starting in verse 19 of chapter 6. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. He challenges our affections and our accumulation of things, which often reveal where our affections lie. But then move on. He says, the eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light that is in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? Notice here, he challenges what captures our attention. What is it that we focus our minds upon? What do we think about? What do we think about? What do we love? What do we think about? And then look at the close here. No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and I don't like this translation. I think it's weak. The original is not money. It is literally mammon. And mammon is a personally infused reality around money. It's demonically influenced money, or the accumulation, or the greed or avarice around money. And so there's almost a spiritual reality. Jesus essentially personifies money by infusing it with an evil personality, if you will, which is exactly what happens when money becomes your God. And essentially what he is challenging here is, where is your loyalty? Where are you giving your allegiance? Where is your allegiance? Now, this wasn't an attempt to create clever alliteration, but we see these three realities in these passages before us. He challenges our affections. He challenges what captures our attention. And he challenges our allegiance. Because honestly, guys, the reality before us is that there is only one thing we have the ability to truly choose in life, and that is, what or who shall be your master? What possesses you as a person and drives you toward the behavior that you engage in? And this is what I want us to be thinking about. So what's another word for a master that is not God? What would be another word in the Bible? Idolatry. That's right. And I think that it's very important for us as Christians, as followers of Jesus, to be able to define or articulate exactly what idolatry is. And so all I would begin with is by saying that you and I, being created in the image of a relational God, means that we are by nature meant to be relational. What's fascinating is that when we engage in the giving of ourselves to the things of this world, how quickly it destroys right and healthy relationships. When we become the center of our worship, how problematic it is for us in regards to the very thing that we were created for, which is worship through relationship with the living God. And what I want to define for you today is that your worship is not something that you do occasionally. Every one of you, every person who has ever lived throughout human history, You are all worshipers. Atheists worship. They just worship their great concept or ideology of what man is capable of without God. Ultimately, in the age of individualism and modernism, that we tend to worship ourselves, honestly. And I always like to say that we make the worst masters, do we not? But whatever we worship is essentially your master. It's the guiding force, the guiding drive in your life. And every one of you worships. So the question is never, do I worship? The question is, what do I worship and how should I worship? What we're going to consider today is this aspect of idolatry, because idolatry defines what you worship and what you give your life to, what you give your affections to, what you give your attention to, and what you give your allegiance to. So I want to begin with this question: what is exactly idolatry? And I think it's defined best in Romans chapter 1, verse 25, when Paul writes, they exchanged the truth of God. He's talking about the wrath of God coming onto earth, the wrath of God, it says, been revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness, for what may be known of God is manifest to the world, so that it is without excuse. And it says, here is the problem, is that humanity in its fallen state exchanged the truth of God, the one who alone can actually handle worship. We exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and we worshiped and served created things rather than the Creator. We worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. Amen. And so there is the great exchange that has created the dilemma of human history, is that through the fall, when our first parents in the garden fell, what is it that they did? Is that in choosing to eat of the fruit that they were told not to, what they were doing in that moment is that they were defining for themselves what is wrong and what is right. Up to that point, God had been the one who defined what is right and what is wrong, but now they are defining for themselves. And I always say that sin in its essence is a rebellion against God's sovereign rule, as well as a rejection of God's goodness and grace. And so as we move into this message, I want you to know that it's easy to focus on that which makes us feel bad, because we emphasize what Jesus tells us not to do, but just know this, that he is only telling us not to do it because he knows it enslaves and kills, and he has come to set you free. And freedom comes from having the right master. You're not free to not have a master. I think that's important for us to understand. So Tim Keller, in his incredible book, Counterfeit Gods, is tiny. So if you're not really a reader, this is one that's very approachable. And actually, there's a series. I'm so sorry, my thing's coming off. I hate this. I'm going to get one of those Britney Spears ones that just wraps around both with a big, just beige mic, and I'm just like, and you feel that? idolatry, that's what I'm talking about. Tim Keller defines idolatry in Counterfeit Gods when he says, it is anything more important to you than God. Anything that absorbs your heart and imagination more than God. Anything you seek to give you what only God can give. Anything that you give yourself to, that you're looking for ultimate satisfaction in. Isn't that incredibly problematic? I mean, when we think about this reality, I mean, we're dealing with a whole series of problems. But look at this. How do we identify with our idols? I mean, a counterfeit God is anything so central and essential to your life that that should you lose it, your life would feel hardly worth living. I'm going to give you an illustration, a personal illustration of this. When I was in my, when I was in my 20s, actually when I was 20 years old, I moved to Seattle to pursue music. And I was incredibly ambitious. I grew up a kid that was insecure, who had all kinds of sort of broken ideas about myself. I was an underachiever in school. And everything that I wanted to do, I couldn't figure out any avenue to do it. And then one day when I turned 20, I wrote my first song. And it was like, it revolutionized my the meaning of life. It became ultimate for me. It essentially drove everything that I thought about, everything that I wanted to do, everything that I wanted to be. And I gave myself with an unbelievable amount of energy to this goal. I quickly put together a band. I didn't know anything. I barely knew how to play my instrument, but I could write songs. And so I just started writing songs, and I would bring my guitar with me every day. This is true devotion to a passion, to an ambition. This is truly collecting for myself treasures on earth, if you will, is that my affection was so given to this thing that I would take my guitar. I remember I worked at Urban Outfitters in 1993 at 20 years old, and I worked with Chris Novoselic's sister, Deanna, who is Chris Novoselic is the bass player for Nirvana. And Chris, I remember Chris would come into Urban Outfitters sometimes to get his sister, and I became friends with her, and I would, because my ambition was so great and my God was so real before me, that if I can get this, if I can make it, if I can do what Nirvana does, then I will be ultimately satisfied and fulfilled, and I will find real meaning. And there's a certain excitement in chasing after that which is unobtainable, isn't there? I mean, especially in youth, because we're just immature enough to think that we're awesome. And I did. My songs suck so bad. That year, they were horrible. They were really bad. And I would make, this is how crazy I was. I would go into the break room at Urban Outfitters in between my shifts, and I'd pull my guitar out, and anyone that was taking a break, I would literally ask if I could play my new song for them. Now, the staff laughs because I still do that to them, but it's different. It's a different ambition altogether. I'm just actually a verbal processor. My wife, she'll go up to get her cup of coffee. I'm like, can I play him a new song? She'll be like, can I just, no, actually you can't. It's for you, I don't care. I actually don't care right now. And those are good because it kills the idolatry very quickly, rejection. But I remember in that time period that I gave a cassette tape of my demos to Chris Novoselic. I wanted him to hear my stuff. And he did nothing for me. I wanted to play him a song. He's like, no. And I was so devastated by that rejection. And why was I devastated? Because in that moment, what Keller says here, that should you lose it, your life would feel hardly worth living. And I remember going to bed that night, and I laid in bed, and I just had this overwhelming sense that I wasn't going to make it. I wasn't going to make what I was giving myself to. I wasn't going to make it in what I was giving myself to, and I cried myself to sleep that night. And I could not think of what it would be worth living if I did not make it in music. I'm like, what would I live for? What would I do? And all of a sudden, anxieties and fears and worries, which we're going to consider next week, is the outcome of having the wrong kind of allegiance and affections, is that ultimately you have to, even if you make it, you have to protect what you've made, and if you don't make it, you're anxious, and if you make it, you're anxious about losing it. And it's a very, very dangerous game that we enter into when we enter into idolatry. But the moral of the story is that I could not imagine what it would be like to be without this thing. And when I woke up the next day, I was like, oh man, that was a bad dream. I was just being silly. I must have been tired, because I'm definitely the most awesome singer-songwriter in Seattle history. And then what happens is that I get a record deal with Mercury, and my song fails at radio. And then I'm working at a record store selling my own album out of the used bin for 99 cents. And it's incredible how each of those things just continue to devastate my heart and devastate my identity, because my whole identity was placed upon this thing in which I started to lose myself. I mean, one of the difficulties for Darcy in those early days was just this reality that I was so given to this ambition that I almost didn't know who I was anymore, because the ambition itself defined me. This is why Claire of Assisi, she is one of the Catholic mystics, says that whatever we love is what we are becoming. She says, if you love nothing, you will become nothing. If you love a thing, you will become a thing. Whoever you love is what you're becoming like. And this is why it is so essential that we have a right understanding of what God has called us to as a people, that he has called us to himself that he might set us free from this idolatry. So I just would ask you here, in looking at this first passage, what has your affection? Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal. Now, here's the powerful thing about this statement that Jesus is making, is notice he starts with the material world. He actually starts with the accumulation, and he's not using money as a way to say that poverty is the only means to righteousness. But he is saying that one who accumulates wealth for the purpose of feeding that idolatry, that finding satisfaction and meaning through serving the ego, because ultimately, why do we accumulate wealth? Well, this is where I want us to understand idolatry on another level, because Jesus begins with the outward reality, because accumulation of wealth and material possessions reveals the deeper idolatry that we often overlook. So my idolatry was music, but was that really my idolatry? Keller has a beautiful picture of this, is that what he calls, there are two kinds of idolatry. There are surface idols, and then there are what he calls deep idols. And surface idols are the things that are actually the easiest to address. So for me, music was that surface idol. When I came to faith, there was a season where I just felt like God told me to just put music down because it was just too important to me. But the problem was is that I did not address the deep idol. The deep idol was the need for power and approval and comfort. I just named four idols, but that's because Calvin said that the human heart is an idol factory. And so what happens, you deal with the surface idol, the accumulation of wealth. Okay, I'm going to give all my possessions away. But what Jesus wants us to do, he's not Buddha. He's not calling us to eradicate desire. He's trying to help us redirect it towards something that's life-giving and freeing. That everything we are, everything we have, everything we possess can serve his kingdom. He wants to bring us to the heart of the matter, which is he wants to get at those deep idols, because those are the things that define our allegiance. Those are the things that define what we think about. Because I thought about music all the time, but really what I was thinking about is I wanted people to love me. And I didn't want people to love me, I wanted people to worship me. I wanted greatness, because I'd never tasted greatness, and I thought greatness would make me, what, satisfied. But if we watched anyone who's reached a level of tremendous greatness ever find really ultimate satisfaction in that, I would say that most of our gods, because I call them gods because people worship people, is that they are false gods in the fact that they themselves cannot handle the worship that they have received. Look at the tragedy of a man like Michael Jackson. I mean, he was barely human by the time he died. Look what worship did to him. And I think that the illustrations go on and on and on. The depths of depravity of the human heart and the need to be loved and the need for power and the need for control and the need for comfort, these are the deep idols that merely, our materialism merely reflects where those idols are. And so this question of where is your affection, we have to begin to ask, why do we give ourselves to these things? And so Jesus is trying to help us see just the faultiness of this, the limitations of it all. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy. Think about the moth. I love this. These pictures of all of it shows the limited realities behind these pursuits that don't ultimately satisfy. Moth, where moth is, I've had multiple vintage suits and vintage clothes through the years, and I actually still have a couple suits that have moth holes in the sleeves. What does it show? It shows the frailty and the fact that things don't last, that even beautiful things can ultimately be eaten away. And where is it most likely to be eaten away? In the closet. So this is what happens with our, is that not only do they not last time-wise, but they don't last for our interest either. Because when we accumulate things, material things, as a means of meaning, which I do it all the time, I still do it. And so a part of that desire to feel connected, but the thing is that you never satisfy. Anytime we get excited about a thing and we get that thing, that excitement, it's the excitement about getting it that keeps driving us. It's like a drug. But the moment we have it, we're already thinking about the next thing. When I got a motorcycle, I wanted a different motorcycle. When I got my iPhone, I wanted a different phone. So let me just give you a picture of what has your affection. Because if this could just say dumb, I would say it. So notice the new iPhone 6 Plus. Notice, if you could see closely, that the sheer weight of my bottom has bent this phone. Fully bent this phone. Because it is a faulty design. God bless Steve Jobs. If he was here, this would not have happened. And what happened? I bend the phone, have it in pocket. I didn't even have it 1 month in my pocket. It's too big, but not big enough. I realize that. It is. It's too big to be a phone, but not big enough to be an iPad. Like, why can't this be my phone? I just want that. So I was sitting because I bent it in studying one morning, and it slips out of my hand, and it falls 1 foot on the tip, and it just shatters. And then the other day, I cut my fingers, stinking scrolling the thing. Like, I scrolled it, and a piece of glass got stuck in my finger, and I'm like, it proves that material things actually are evil. And it was like, I'm like, now Apple, now you're taking your faulty design out on me personally, the consumer. But it proves just that why was I so excited about this? Now I need a new one. So I'm like, this is dumb. I need a different kind of phone, but not this phone. And it doesn't exist yet, but as soon as it does, I'll be, and you don't, and we're like, oh, that's ridiculous. Some of you stood in line at Apple overnight to get your phone, because I don't know, but there was 1,000 people at the downtown store. Odds are someone in this room was that dumb. And we would like you to stand up right now as we conclude this message, that we might pray over your idolatry. But the fact is it wears out. But you know what happens is, not only does this wear out, but as we give ourselves again and again to the next thing, the next gadget, as we accumulate these things, what happens? I have iPhones in drawers that are playthings for my daughter now. They're like, don't work. You know, the last one, did I even need this? Well, I kind of did. But I'm like, my battery's bad on it. It dies kind of fast now. And I think that's sort of the cleverness of Apple. It is a weird, you know, hellish empire that I have given my loyalty to. But my last phone, did it work? Yes. Did I need to charge it more often than I wanted to? Yes. Did it mean I should upgrade to a new phone that costs money? Why did I want it? Because this looks awesome. But then I got it and I felt dumb. I pulled it out. And you know what everyone kept saying? Like, oh my gosh, that phone is obnoxiously big. And I'm like, well, it's not that big. Like, and and what was I looking for? What is it that drives? And all I'm saying is that there's a default reality in our human nature that longs for attention. Even the things that we get, ultimately, we want comfort, we want respect, we want love. And these are deep idols that you can get rid of one surface idol, and all of a sudden you just take that deep idol and apply it to something else. You know how dangerous it is that my desire and my deep idol my surface idol was music? Okay, I give up music, and then I enter into ministry. How terrifying is it when you see a preacher whose desire is still to be considered a great communicator, whose desire is to be considered a great leader, who wants the adoration of people? That's why when Spurgeon was told one morning after he gave a sermon by a woman, has anyone told you what an incredible preacher you are? And he said, yes, Satan did 5 minutes ago. Because this is the reality that's before us. The idolatry of the human heart is a real thing, and Jesus knows it, and he knows it enslaves us. And as this has cracks all over the screen, I believe as we give ourselves to this, it creates cracks in our souls. it destroys. It's like rust. What causes rust? Time. Time causes rust. Being consistently confronted with the elements of the... It's so big, it was actually uncomfortable in my front pocket. Just to finish that thought. So you have rust destroying, like time doesn't satisfy. And you think about these things, the ways that time is, like, you can be the biggest star in the world in 1975. Who was one of the biggest bands in the world? Kiss. Do you guys like Kiss? I didn't like Kiss. I thought they were always bad. And they were a pathetic version of glam rock that I could not accept. But they were huge. I did like that weird 70s movie, the Carnival movie with Kiss. But my mom thought it was evil. Didn't you, Mom? My mom's here right now. You did think it was evil, I remember. So here's the great story about Kiss. So Kiss, massive, giant band. And then in Longview, Washington, where I grew up, the beautiful, peaceful mill town of Longview, 45 minutes outside of Portland, I saw one night at the Woodshed Tavern across the street from the mill. Who was playing at the Woodshed? Ace Frehley. Ace Frehley from Kiss. Yesterday's star today. No, that's they don't. How did he end up at the Woodshed? Because nobody cares anymore. And the fact is that we think of our own importance as something. Our idolatry is around this desire for legacy, but legacy is quickly turned into idolatry when we think that people are going to remember. Listen, things rust, people rust, people forget. We live in the day in which Andy Warhol said that everyone will be famous for 15 minutes. What's the biggest app of last year? You guys, anyone know? Snapchat. You guys know what Snapchat is? I just learned what it is because I don't even know how to use Facebook. But Snapchat is where you literally text your friend, and it's like Instagram on speed. So it's like, here's a picture of me. Wait, it's gone. No, it's seriously, it's 5 seconds. I think, is it five, am I right? Is it 5 minutes? 10 seconds. Oh, I'm sorry, 10 seconds. Because that's a tremendous amount of time to be able to take in someone's life. So what do you do with Snapchat? Well, here's the thing. People are so obsessed with it that Snapchat drives an individualism to a whole new disgusting, weird, self-worshipping level, because the only way for people to notice that you're on Snapchat is to do what? You're like speed selfie. Like you have to just, like they probably didn't see that one because it's already gone. They didn't see this one either because it's already gone. They didn't, like, so I actually picture someone who's really OCD just sitting in a room and they never actually leave the spot all day because they're so afraid that the last one wasn't seen. And this is the thing, that sounds ridiculous, but there are people that are posting up to thousands Snapchats plus a day. You're like, whoa. And you're like, did I do that? How often do we look at Instagram? How often do we spend our time? I was at Disneyland. We act like we don't do these things. But people, our natural tendency is that we are captivated and captured by things that don't last. And no one remembers. Snapchat is the desire to make people remember you, but the only way to make them remember you is to keep yourself ever in front of them. But you can't do it. Time is not on your side. The death rate seems to be one per person. We're moving through life toward an end, toward a goal, and Jesus wants to set us free from that. Look at this, and where thieves break in and steal, someone else will come in and take your glory. Kiss was big in the 70s, nobody cares now. But what about the next thing, the new thing? And so whatever it is that you think you're good at, think about this, the ways that we put ourselves in a place, it just violates the deep idols, is to know that whatever it is that you do, there's always someone a lot better than you. And so it's devastating for the soul when our attention and our focus and the giving of ourselves goes to these things. And Jesus knows that, and he's trying to protect us. And this is why he says, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. And not nature, not time, not people. Nobody can take this from you. But when God himself is your gift in him, you have all things. The greatest gift that God gives is what? God Himself. We are a royal priesthood. What did God say to the priests in the Old Testament? And the Levites, the priests, shall have no inheritance in the land. Their attention was not to be given to the material. It's not, this isn't a dualistic thing. This isn't about spirit is good, physical is bad. It's about a reprioritizing of affections so that we can function in a material world properly. It's not about putting yourself in forced poverty. It's not about giving up your relationships. It's about making sure that the supreme affection of your heart is Jesus. To the priest, he said, they shall have no inheritance in the land, for the Lord their God is their inheritance. That the gift of God is so big, there's so little room for other things. I think this is why the Apostle Paul stayed single, is that he was so enraptured with Jesus that literally there was no room in his existence for anything else. It's just pouring himself out for everyone that he met, that they might come to know King Jesus. And he knew that if he was to give himself to a wife, he even says it in 1 Corinthians, that now your attention is going to be split. You're going to, because you have a responsibility. He's not diminishing marriage. He's just saying, for me personally, my affection, it was so insane for Jesus and his kingdom. It's so life-giving that there's nothing else I would rather do. This is what's going to be supreme in my thinking. This is where my treasure is. And so, guys, I want to just reiterate, for idolatry for you, some of you, it may be literally accumulation of wealth. In Portland, unlikely. Maybe for some of you, it's the idea of making it or getting wealth, because that can be just as much of an idol. It's not just those who have that have a difficult time of getting into the kingdom of heaven. It's those who want as well. Remember the Ten Commandments. Shall not covet what your neighbor has. It's all driven from the same desire, the position in life. It's just some have position, some don't, but both want it, and both want to protect it when they have it, and both long for it and focus on it when they don't have it. And so these kind of idolatries are damaging. For some of you, you don't even understand that idolatry is your children. I met with a young man here at the church who was telling me that his parents were on the verge of divorce because now that him and his brothers had graduated from high school and were no longer at home, his parents didn't know what to live for anymore. They didn't know how to communicate. They didn't have any kind of focus because for them, their God was their kids. They even bought a condo in another state so they could be by him while they were at college. And I actually read an article in the New York Times about that becoming a growing trend because people are just grasping for something to bring ultimate meaning to them. If I have a child, that will bring ultimate meaning. If I have a wife or a husband, that will bring ultimate meaning. If I have this job or that job, if I could get to this level financially, I will have real lasting meaning. None of it lasts. You have no guarantee if you, as a parent, that you'll even have your kids tomorrow. And the reality is that if your kids are the center of your focus, you will not actually have them forever unless they're weird. Actually, I take that back. Mamas, if you have boys, you'll probably have them a long time, according to statistics in this city. But, you know, we don't want to breed a batch of parasite singles. And so we're going to keep moving toward freedom in the gospel, freedom from idolatry. And so I love that quote, what we become what we love, and who we love shapes what we become. If we love things, we become a thing. If we love nothing, we become nothing. I just want to keep bringing that to your attention. So let me ask you, what has your attention? Look what Jesus goes on to say. The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? And here is that the reality that not only what we love defines who we are, but what we love actually comes from what we have given our thinking over to. What do you think about? What do you spend the majority of your time looking at, focusing on? I love this, even the singularity of Jesus' word. He doesn't say the eyes, he says the eye. And what he's moving toward is that this, if we take it in its context of accumulation, of living in a way, because as kingdom people, we're to live under the rule of King Jesus, who gave himself away. And it was through the total surrender of self to the will of the Father that Jesus is able to say, I alone can set people free. What does he set us free from? The tyranny of the need to protect self and to worship self and to elevate self. And one of the things that he's getting at here is actually an old Hebrew idea that we find in the Proverbs, which is that of the greedy eye or the generous eye. That the eye, that what you think about is your focus on what can make my life better, my life more satisfying, my life more appealing to others? Or is it about, am I looking out into the world to see how I can give myself away according to the ways of King Jesus? And so it goes to that we must ask the question, what then has our attention? Because how we look at the world is defined by how we think about it. When you look out at the world, you can either see people as opportunities to serve self, or you can look out at the world and see people the way that Jesus sees. So what lens are you looking at? Because Jesus says here, the eye is the lamp of the body, and I think that that's true. Have you ever met someone that has, and I'm not talking about crystal blue eyes or that spark in their, have you ever met a believer that literally has almost illuminated eyes? I've only known a couple that I literally would say there was like a weird light coming from their eyes. And one of them was a 91-year-old woman at Solid Rock. And she had, her name is Isabel and her husband Tom. They were both 91 and they would come to my morning Bible study every Wednesday morning, every Wednesday at 6 a.m. when I worked there. And Isabel would just sit in the front row. And she would just come up to me and she'd grab my hand and she'd just look at me and she goes, can I pray for you? And when she would pray for you, both my wife and I experienced this, she didn't close her eyes, she literally looked through your soul to Jesus. And it was crazy. I'm like, I am somewhere between heaven and earth right now. and it's like she was already there with the Lord. And that single-minded focus upon Jesus, having a generous eye, she saw the world as God's world, and she saw her life as his life, and she saw her mission as showing people his love. And because of that, her eyes literally had this weird, it's like, I swear, in a dark room it would be like those nocturnal animals where their eyes glow. Like I'm like, I wonder if her eyes glow at night, because there was just this, there was something supernatural about her, because the light in her was good. But here's one of the most damaging realities for us, is that the deception of sin and the reality of darkness is that we don't realize that as our attention is given to things, as supremacy moves from Jesus to the things of this world, to our relationships, to our jobs, to our possessions, to the, you know, we spend our time looking at design blogs and you know, listening, focusing our attention on trying to take in every new record that comes out, and we're concerned with the newest fashion. And I'm only stating things that I can think of that I do. It was like, how do we deal with this? Because we begin to become what it is that we're giving our minds to. And so you give yourself to just surface level existence, and you're just obsessed with what is the newest trend and newest thing that's cool and beautiful, is that it will create a shallow person. You give yourself to, how do I accumulate more wealth? How do I become a more powerful man? I just read an article from the New Yorker from 2012 that they've done a series of studies that shows that those who give themselves to the accumulation of wealth have a tendency toward a greater level of isolation and actually a loss of empathy for others. They're also, because of the loss of empathy, more likely to make it. It's fascinating. They found that those in countries where jobs were not as prevalent, in third world countries, there was a greater sense of community. Now, I don't think that we need to be impoverished to enjoy real community, but just know, by the world standards, every one of you are rich. And our wealth in our country has made a very individualistic society. But remember, I say, let's eradicate the word individual. For God is three persons, not three individuals. And the personhood of God is defined by his relationship within himself. And he's called us to become persons in relationship, which creates distinctness that's defined by its unity. And so this is the thing, is that when our eyes bad, when we give ourselves to our focus to these things, is that we don't even realize it, but soon the whole body's full of darkness. And then we begin to justify the faulty behavior. Because have you ever just felt that God is telling you to put something away, to stop doing something, to stop putting your focus and attention on that? I think that one of the main ways I see that is in relationships, when the affections, really romantic affections, grow, and you talk with the person, and everyone's telling them the same thing: you shouldn't be with this person. And then what happens is that as you deceive yourself into thinking that it's right, even though your community is telling you it's bad, is that soon what happens is you isolate yourself in the community because you will not be satisfied with the answer until you get the answer that you want. And I think that I've seen that not only in relationships but with pursuits that are clearly destructive. Giving himself over to things. We do it with behaviors because the idolatry of the heart is real. And so Jesus says we need a generous eye, an eye that is giving itself, that looks at the world with how can I give myself away for the kingdom of God, not how can I get from what I see, because that darkens the soul. It does not enlighten it. And then finally, I just would ask you this: where is your allegiance? Because I began this sermon with this question. You have to ask, who do I serve? Because the one choice that you have is who will be your master. Who will be your master? And as far as I can tell, Jesus is the only one who can say, come to me and I'll give you rest. And I have never found anyone who has made themselves their own master, and even through massive accomplishments in life, can say that there was any sort of lasting significance, because idolatry is one of two things that we're told in the entire New Testament to run for our lives from. And yet it's there every day. No one can serve two masters, for either hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Greed, avarice, the giving of ourselves to the desires of this world, it can't be what defines us. I close with this verse from 1 John 2:15 through 17. Look at this with me. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. So there, he's challenging our affections for all that is in the world. And he's not talking about the world as we know it, material, but the world system that is under the control of darkness. It's a difference between which kingdom are you going to be, kingdom of light, kingdom of dark. There isn't kingdom of gray, by the way, anywhere in the Bible. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, that's uncontrolled appetites, and the desires of the eyes, destructive thinking, and the pride of life, wrong motivation, is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away along with its desires. These things are going to go away. And so it's not getting rid of appetites, but it's reshaping them, redirecting them. It's not getting rid of thinking, but it's having our minds renewed through the gospel and through daily time in the word and life in the community. And it's not getting rid of motivation, but it's having a whole new foundation to work from, a new purpose, that living for Jesus brings the ultimate satisfaction to life. And if it's not so, what are we doing here? It's true. Whoever does the will of God abides forever. What is the will of God? I would argue there is no will of God apart from Jesus. Jesus is the will of God revealed in the flesh. We're always looking for what is God's will for my life personally? To follow Jesus and then let him show you where he's going to go. Why are we worrying about ourselves? It just proves the problem of idolatry even more. So Jesus is challenging our goals, because our goals are our God's. And so I ask you, where is your affection? Where is your intention? Where is your attention? And where is your allegiance? May Jesus be our master, that we might truly live as a kingdom people. Amen.